Another year, another crisis. It seems they come one after another these days. As inflation skyrockets, today we talk to a leading economic thinker about the almighty hit, indeed the catastrophe, facing the incomes of working class people.
Good evening. Today, some tough medicine for an American economy racked by high inflation.
Back to the top story of the day, the Fed raising rates to the highest level since the pandemic.
The cost of living in the UK is rising, and it's changing people's lives.
Are there days when you're having to skip meals?
2 days ago, I had, I think it was 4 sandwiches. Michelle sat there and she didn't eat anything.
Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper, and my co-host, Zoe Williams. Today, we're delighted to welcome back onto the show Gary Stevenson, the former City of London trader turned champion of the working class. He talks us through the economic dynamics of the current crisis and how we build the people's alternative. So, Gary, how you been? It's been a while. How's post-pandemic... Well, kind of post-pandemic, endemic life treating you?
It's busy. It's very, very busy. When did we last speak? How long ago was it?
I think it was just at the beginning of lockdown, because I remember it was just when Keir had been elected. And I remember thinking he really needed some of your energy. And back then, I still had a bit of hope that he would listen to people.
Yeah.
So even tracing this memory is making me depressed.
Okay, well, let's move on quickly from it then. Okay, so if we last spoke at the beginning of lockdown, that's relevant because what I was doing at the beginning of lockdown was writing articles and making videos basically saying we are about to give an unbelievably huge amount of money, essentially printed government money, to rich people. And that is going to cause a massive crisis of inflation, of inequality, of living standards for ordinary people. And people weren't that interested at the time because they were largely trying not to get COVID. But here we are with a massive crisis of inflation and inequality and living standards. And everybody's saying, oh my God, isn't it terrible that Vladimir Putin's done this?
Is this the direct result of, you know, the assorted furlough schemes and basically, the, you know, that what everybody was considering that wave of generosity from Sunak at the start of the pandemic, is that what's created the inflationary pressure?
In my opinion, yes. And you will get people that will argue against that. But when they argue against that, I think it's worth recognising that I've been saying this is going to happen for 2 years. And they probably haven't been. I mean, the most important thing to recognise is the government spent an enormous amount of money dealing with the economic crisis of COVID. And all of that money was essentially printed money, right? This is a new way of dealing with economic crises. And you know, we can see now through the mechanisms which I speak about on my channel, which I've written articles about, that money ended up with the richest. Now, imagine I came to you 3 years ago, before you ever heard of COVID, and I said to you, what do you think would happen if the government printed £450 billion, which is £10,000 for every adult in the country, and gave all of that money to the richest 5-10% of the country? Imagine that someone asked you that question. You know, it's obviously going to cause problems. What kind of problems do you think it would cause? Well, it's the number one consequence you would expect is a crisis of inflation, right? You can't just, you know, historically, governments don't deal with massive economic crises by just printing an absolute ton of money, right? That's not normally what they do, but they did it. And the reason they don't do that is because of a risk of inflation crises, right? This was always the risk. But I think the thing which drives me the most mad was, if you are going to do that, if you are, as a government, going to spend an ungodly amount of money, and I really want to emphasise how huge that is. I think it's worth sort of comparing, you know, recently the government set out, I think, £15 billion rescue package. Well, the amount of money transferred from the government to the rich in the last 2 years is £450 billion, right? So it's 30 times larger. It's unbelievably larger than usual sort of fiscal measures taken by governments, like to these sorts of scales, 30 times larger, 50 times larger. If you're going to give out £450 billion, and they kind of had to do it during COVID, at the very least, somebody needs to do a basic analysis of where that money is going to end up, which is the first thing I did at the beginning of COVID. Name me one person in government who did this basic analysis saying, look, we're going to give out £450 billion, but it's going to end up here and we're going to deal with that. Who did that?
But no, can I just drill in a little bit? How did it all? I mean, I know I'm sounding really naive, but how did all end up in the hands of the richest?
No, it's a very, very good question. It's something that we should talk about. So this was basically my big line at the very beginning of the crisis. So my background is I was a trader and I made a lot of money by understanding the effects of inequality on the economy. So whenever anything big happens, just purely from a trading perspective, there's always money to be made if you understand what's going to happen to inequality, because economists generally underplay the significance of this. So if you know what's going to happen to inequality, you have a good insight into what's going to happen to the economy. So at the beginning of COVID, I could see this huge amount of money was going to get poured in. And when money gets poured in by the government, somebody ends up with the money. That's basic accounting. But what was interesting is it wasn't immediately obvious who was going to end up with this money, right? Because if you consider something like furlough scheme, which is one of the biggest costs of government during COVID, right? That money went directly to poor and ordinary people. So a lot of people on the left were super happy. They're like, here, we're finally getting the kind of stimulative policy from the government helping the poor that we've always wanted. So people were happy about it, right? But if you look at the situation of furloughed workers, they're not richer than they were before COVID, right? They're getting this money from the government, but it's explicitly 80% of their former wages. So we know clearly these guys are poorer. So we know the money's been poured in, but we know the initial recipients of the money are no richer. So it creates this kind of mystery. Okay, well, who's richer? And I was obsessed with this at the beginning of COVID, right? And so the reason that the furloughed workers are not richer, despite receiving a huge amount of money from government, is because they're not getting paid their wages, obviously. Okay, so who's got the wages? Well, it's the companies that are not paying the wages, right? So let's look at the companies. Are the companies richer? Well, the companies are not paying the wages, but actually the companies have been totally shut down and are receiving no income, right? So the companies are not richer. Okay, so who's got the income which normally goes to the companies? Well, that is the customers. And this is actually the correct answer. The people who accumulated money during COVID were customers. And when people hear this, they might rightly be like, okay, well, I'm a customer. Where's my £10,000? And this is the important point, because not all customers accumulated money during COVID. If you are an ordinary family, or especially if you're a poorer family, the vast majority of your expenditures are rent, mortgage, food, bills. Those expenditures remained during COVID. But if you're a very, very rich family, your vast majority of your expenditures are luxury expenditures like holidays, like fine dining, like going to the theatre. If you have a high amount of luxury expenditure, your expenditure will have collapsed during COVID. So what basically happened was people accumulated money during COVID pretty much exactly proportional to their usual luxury spend, which is a pretty good proxy measure of how rich you are. So basically, rich people started to accumulate a huge amount of cash during COVID because they weren't spending. And then the government came in and replaced their spending, because their spending is essential for the poor to receive their wages. But the poor received those wages, immediately spent the money on mortgage, rent, food, bills, which gives it straight to the rich. And then the rich started to accumulate it. So essentially what you have is 2 years of the government completely replacing the spending of the rich. And from the perspective of an ordinary person, that looks fine, right? Because you're not getting your pay, but you're getting this money from the government. But from the perspective of a rich person, this money is just piling up in their account. So it's £450 billion. It's such a huge amount of money. So in that period of time, you're not going to be able to just go back to a normal economy when you have transferred £450 billion cash from the government to the rich.
Isn't there two levels? Like, what happened? There's the billionaires that made massive amounts from COVID. You know, those that basically bought stocks when they collapsed in value in 2020, and then they rocketed in value as all of this capital was it, or printed money was injected back into the economy to support the economy by central banks and states. And of course, they're sitting on vast earnings. So I suppose I just want to ask how that fits in your picture, because, you know, maybe quite a few of our listeners will be thinking, well, you know what? Yeah, actually, I did get through COVID and I had £8,000 in my bank. And that was weird because I don't usually save any money, but I don't really feel like a rich person.
Well, I think the first thing to point out is we can work out very, very easily what the average amount of cash accumulation was during COVID just by looking at the amount of money given out divided by the number of adults in the country. And that is about £10,000. So the average adult accumulated £10,000 cash extra from government during COVID. So if you got £8,000, like in the example you're mentioning, you've actually lost. You are poorer post-COVID than you were pre-COVID, because you have got, you've been given less than the average person. So your relative position in society has fallen. But I think this is actually the sort of the real power. And it was driving me mad during COVID when everybody loved Rishi Sunak, because it's very, very easy to be popular when you're giving a ton of printed money out. You know, people like receiving £8,000. But the truth is, if the government gives everyone an average £10,000 and you have been given £8,000, you are poorer than you previously were. That's how money works. You know, it's a relative asset. It's a relative asset. So, and, you know, it was very clear through the, for me, at the beginning of COVID, through the, basically the mechanisms that I've gone through with you, that the money would largely accumulate to richer people. But it's interesting to think about what happens then next, okay? You give £10,000. Let's assume that it went to the top 10%, which I think is a fair sort of rough approximation. It's quite striking, right? Because if all of that money, £10,000 per adult, goes to the top 10%, that means that the average adult in the top 10% accumulates £100,000, right? Which is really a huge amount of money, right? So let's assume that happened. And I think actually, you know, in reality, it's not all to the top 10%, but it's a pretty good rough approximation. Every single adult in the top 10, and this is not every single household, this is every single adult. So if you've got, you know, two adults with three grown kids, that's £500,000 they're accumulating on average, right? If you give this enormous amount of cash to the rich, well, what are they going to do? Okay, well, you know, they probably will increase their spending a bit, but richer people, we know when they get given cash, they tend to try and invest it, right? Okay, so suddenly there's this huge amount of money trying to be invested. Well, what does that do? It's obviously going to push up the price massively of investment assets. And one of my big predictions at the beginning of COVID was that we'd see a massive rise in house prices. But we also saw a massive rise in stock prices. You know, I was investing in gold. You saw a big rise in the gold price. But the problem is, who owns the assets? It's rich people, right? So if these guys are just buying assets off of each other, number one, they get massively richer because the asset prices go through the roof. And number two, they don't actually get rid of the money, right? Because they're just buying assets from each other. So I think people tend to think, okay, there's a cash accumulation. And I saw this kind of thinking from a lot of economists during the crisis, which is, okay, people have accumulated a ton of cash during the crisis, but they're going to spend it. That's not how money works. If I spend my money buying something from you, then you have the money. The money doesn't disappear. That money, because the government has given that money out, that money will permanently exist until the government taxes it back. So these people simply cannot get rid of the money. And it is inevitable that eventually they will start to increase their consumption because they simply cannot get rid of the money, and it's the only thing they can do. So I think I don't want to put any guilt on anyone who's accumulated £7,000-£8,000, because the truth is most of the richest people in the country have accumulated vastly, vastly more than that. But what is important to recognise is that it's an enormous amount of money. And the obvious consequence of that would be a crisis of inflation and a crisis of living standards for the people who didn't get the money. And you know, I'm not just saying this. All the statistics bear this out. Okay, the first year of COVID saw the biggest ever one-year increase in wealth of millionaires and billionaires in the country, a 22% single-year increase in wealth. The average billionaire increased the wealth by £730 million at the beginning of COVID. And from pure accounting fact, we know with absolute certainty that holdings of cash in society are £450 billion bigger. And yet we're sitting here at the end of COVID with a genuine crisis in living standards for the majority of the country. And we're scratching our heads saying, what can we possibly do? Well, we've given out £450 billion. You can tax it back. But nobody is talking about it. And you can probably tell it's driving me pretty mad.
So let's come back later to talking about maybe what we do about it. But could it, at this stage, you talk us through just how bad this crisis and this cost of living crisis is, the scale of it, what it means to people?
It's really bad. It's really, really, really bad. And it's going to get significantly worse. And you could have predicted this, just as I predicted this early on in the crisis, just by simply knowing how big the rise in inequality would be. I mean, just that basic surface level analysis, if you massively increase inequality, the most obvious thing you would expect is a massive increase in living standards of the rich and a massive decrease in living standards of the rest. And that is exactly what we are seeing. And I think it's important to realise that, you know, if we were to bring in a tax where we taxed ordinary people 10 grand and gave it all to the rich, people would be up in arms. But if you do that by printing money and giving it to the rich, the effect is the same on living standards. But obviously people don't notice it. So I think it's actually, really, it's a genius move what the government has done, which is to give an enormous amount of money to the rich by funneling it through the poor so that they can look like they've given money to the poor, but actually they've given money to the rich.
Do you think it was that calculating? Do you think they knew that?
No. Listen, I've worked in economics for a long, long time. These guys are not smart enough to do that on purpose. What it is they know where their bread's buttered. They know what they have to do, which is support the poor. And they know what they have to do, which is make the rich richer. And they find ways to make both those things work. So during the crisis, the obvious and correct thing to do would have been to tax the rich who made a ton of money during COVID and use that to support the poor. But you don't actually have to do that if you print money, right? If you just print money, you can support the poor without taxing the rich. So for them, it looks perfect. You support the poor and the poor are happy because you gave them a ton of money. And you don't tax the rich because the rich are happy because you didn't tax them. But the consequence is a massive crisis of inflation. I think this should be pretty obvious surface level analysis, you know. But I think, listen, I've worked in economics for a long time. You know, I've worked with a lot of people like Rishi Sunak. I've seen a lot of empty suits, you know. He didn't know this was going to happen. And, you know, if you look at the economic forecasts of traders, of people in government, people in the central bank, they didn't expect this. You know, and there's a wider question here about why our professional economists are so bad. It's probably connected to the fact that if you're a really good economist, you can make £1 million a year working in the city. So why would you be working in public service? But, OK, I don't think they expect it. I worked in economics for a long time. I think really these guys are just trying to make it work, but they're making sure that they get paid and the rich get paid because that is what their number one priority is. But to get back to your question about how bad this is, realistically, we're talking about thousands of pounds extra annual cost of living, right? Which in many, many cases, I would say about half of the households in the country, that is more than their disposable income in a year. So they literally cannot afford basic living anymore. You're taking half the country and saying, you guys cannot afford to live. You will be forced now to either move into substandard accommodation or stop heating your home in the winter or stopping eating regular meals. This is serious what's happening, right? And then you've got 20% above that who maybe they can afford it, but you're wiping out their entire disposable income. So you're saying to these guys, okay, you guys can afford to live, but you can't go to the pub, you can't go to the football, you can't go on holiday, you can't do shopping for clothes anymore. That stuff has to go. So what does that do to the economy? You're basically getting rid of the entire spend of 70% of the population. Well, obviously, that means businesses will shut down, right? Because they need the spending. But then, at the same time, we know that this enormous amount of money has been given to the rich. So that will obviously push up house prices. So what are families going to do? If you're like, consider my parents, right? They're pretty poor, but they're retired now, but they own their own house. And now they're going to struggle to pay the bills year after year. It is inevitable that they will respond to that by selling their house. Of course they will. What else are they going to do? They were probably hoping to be able to keep that house to give it to my sister or help my sister buy her own property. Now they're not going to be able to do that. Well, where's that house going to go? That house is going to be owned by the rich. So it will have knock-on consequences to inequality or make inequality worse. Honestly, I cannot describe how this will change this country permanently. And in a very real way, it will end this country as a first world country in the sense of a country which provides or attempts to provide decent living standards to the majority of its population. That will never happen again. That is over now. And it's not just this country. It's happening all across Europe. It's happening in America. This is a disaster. This is a cataclysmic disaster. And, it brings me no joy to say that, but people need to know this is not a temporary crisis. This is not even the new normal. This is the beginning of a continued rapid descent. And, I don't like to say that, but, I make a lot of money betting on that and people need to know.
Wow.
Oof.
I know. I'm actually silenced for a second.
Yeah, we're not often stunned into silence on this podcast, I must say.
Yeah, well, I carry this around every day.
Brexit has happened, and many of the things we warned about are coming true. But no one seems to want to talk about it. Here at Another Europe, we say it's time for meaningful accountability and real scrutiny. And that's where our new project, Brexit Spotlight, comes in. We're breaking the silence and shining a light on the calamities. Find out more at brexitspotlight.org.
So Gary, like, maybe one thing that listeners might be thinking about, that we've lived through at least two, for argument's sake, in recent times, major economic crises, the 2008 financial crisis. And in the aftermath of that, you made a lot of money betting on the fact that there wouldn't be sustained increases in the interest rates because of the scale of the depression and the consumption demand crisis in the economy. How is this crisis now that we are moving into that seems very different? And of course, for policymakers, I think part of the explanation to why they didn't expect inflation to be this serious is because they pumped so much money into the economy after 2008, and it just led to sustained deflation, or it didn't stop a sustained deflationary problem. So we had very low interest rates. In this crisis, they pumped loads of money in again, and they expected the effect to be, maybe we'll have to raise interest rates a bit, but you know, there's so many deflationary pressures in the global economy, it'll probably be okay. So what does the, so how do you link those two things together? What changed with this crisis compared to the 2008 one?
So I think the first thing, which is important to realise, which seems to have slipped out of the public consciousness, or maybe it was simply because it was so long ago, is we had a very, very similar economic situation in 2011. The only difference really was scale. Now, I was a trader in 2011, and at the time, the public narrative in the press was, we have a strong rebounding economy, but a cost of living crisis. And we had inflation at about 5% for about a year and a half, which was driven primarily by natural resources, by food and energy. It's very, very similar. The only real difference is the scale. Do you see what I'm saying? I think, and we've just forgotten that that happened. And then what happened after that was, you know, to be honest, I view the two crises as in many ways very similar. The only real difference is scale. You know, you had a massive crisis, which fundamentally, economically, comes down to a collapse in spending, primarily from the rich. The government propped it up, which essentially creates a transfer of cash from the government to the rich. That caused a big increase in money supply, and that caused a big increase in inflation. But then you stop increasing the money supply and the inflation calms down. And I expect the inflation, I think, will calm down. I mean, it's important to understand that when you print money, it causes inflation. In 2008, we saw inflation a couple of years afterwards, just like this time, a couple of years afterwards. Then it slowed down. But the other thing which is important to realise is after 2008, what we had in terms of inflation was a one-off jump in basic cost of living, which was temporary. The jump was temporary, but the change in cost of living was essentially permanent. But we had 15 years of extremely high inflation in asset prices. And I actually think what we'll see this time is very, very similar. I think what we're seeing now, this very high rates of inflation, that will come down. The inflation will come down. It might take a year or so. But relative prices will remain permanently changed, which means the cost of basic living will remain permanently higher relative to basic wages, which is the same as 2008, which means we move to a new situation of permanently worsened living standards for ordinary workers. But this money is still flowing around. But because it's increasingly in the hands of the very rich, it's no longer pushing up basic prices, but it continues to push up assets. So I actually think, you know, I think we'll see a similar thing. I think inflation will come back down, but living standards will be permanently worse. But asset prices, such as house prices and stock prices, will continue to rise. And I think interest rates, and this is a counter consensus view, I think interest rates will come back down. It'll probably take a couple of years. But the thing is, ultimately, what we have done in the last year, and in the coming year especially, is absolutely kill the spending power of the average person in this country. And that is going to devastate the economy. And ultimately, then you will have low inflation and the central banks will be forced to cut rates. So I don't think they are different. I think the only difference is the scale.
Again, I'm stunned into silence.
We can only be stunned into silence once.
No, I know. It's just it's sort of when you lay it out like that, it makes me realise that the kind of bickering around the edges of what an opposition should look like is really insufficient to the kind of programmatic response that would be needed.
Yeah, I think nothing makes that clearer than the numbers. You know, £450 billion, okay? And you know, I know these big numbers, they all blend into one, okay? But that is £10,000 per adult. Imagine a piece of fiscal policy which affected every single adult in the country by £10,000. okay? That is beyond the scale of anything really feasibly imaginable by a modern government, okay? And then the amounts of money which the government proposes to fix it, £15 billion, £20 billion, are literally 20, 30 times less. So what we are doing here as a society is literally, we're sticking plasters onto a gushing wound. That it's, we are not thinking in the scale required. And at this stage, economic disaster is basically inevitable. Because the biggest, my biggest concern when the war in Ukraine happened was immediately, yeah, I'm thinking entirely from the perspective of the UK consumer, this will take the entire blame for the inflation. The inflation started before the war. I think it's important for people to realise that. But the war will take the entire blame for the inflation, and the fact that the rich have made an unbelievably enormous amount of money off the government in the last 2 years will be completely forgotten. Because if you forget about that money and do nothing about that money, you will destroy the economy. And that is what is happening now. And it's about numbers. £450 billion is too large. You cannot give the rich that amount of money and expect no consequences.
Not to play devil's advocate, because I don't really disagree, but I suppose thinking about your argument, I mean, there are some global geopolitical factors at work here that add like another layer of instability and crisis to the whole picture. I'm thinking not only the war in Ukraine, but if you look at what's happening to the Chinese economy and how that's changed over since the last crisis 15 years ago, where China was able to play this role of having this long-term deflationary impact on the cost of goods. And now China can't play that role. I mean, its economy is in a lot of difficulty because of its sticking to zero COVID policy. But in any case, it's trying to build a much bigger middle class, and the cost of labour in China is going up. So does that make this push back against your point around this crisis is broadly similar to the one in 2011? Because the China effect in 2011 had this kind of savior effect on the global economy.
No, I think these are the factors. What's happening in China, obviously what's happening in Ukraine, these are obviously inflationary. They are inflationary. There are other inflationary things happening. My concern is that they're taking the whole blame, and what that is doing is completely, I mean, it's enormous. This £450 billion, no one's talking about it. And that is a fixable problem, okay? We in this country, we can't really affect what's happening in China. It seems relatively clear. There's a limited amount we can affect what's happening in Ukraine. But we can fix that £450 billion, right? That is what is in our power to fix. And it's the one problem which we can fix, nobody's talking about it. Nobody's talking about it. And in my opinion, that effect is larger, you know, to the UK consumer, of course. And listen, I've never denied that there are other things that are happening that are inflationary. But I think a lot of people on the left like to deny my point that if you give £450 billion to the rich, that is inflationary. But that is the thing we can fix. That is the thing we can fix, and we're not fixing it. And, you know, we're in a situation now where, you know, we're really throwing tens of millions of people in this country into poverty whilst we have simultaneously given £450 billion to the rich, which they still have, and have seen the biggest ever increase in billionaire and millionaire wealth in the country. And we're just shrugging our shoulders that there's nothing that can be done. That £450 billion is out there. We could tax it. We could take it back. And if we did that, we could increase our support for the cost of living crisis by literally 5,000%. The size is too large. It cannot be ignored. So I've never denied that there are other things which are causing inflationary pressures in the world. But there is also this £450 billion, and that's a problem that we can fix.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, people in China can't affect the policy of the Chinese government either, but that's another question. But as you're the mystic Meg of the economics world, showing my age there, like, what about unemployment? Like you mentioned earlier that, you know, the effect of this is going to be that businesses go bust because no one's going to be buying anything because people won't have enough money to afford to live, you know, their really basic commodities that they need to live. And so unemployment presumably is going to go up as businesses go bust. Do you expect to see that?
Well, you know what? I think in a sense, this is a somewhat anachronistic way of viewing the economy. So I think when it comes to employment, I think we're in a very interesting space now economically. Okay, now, I've spoken about it a lot. The government printed and gave out £450 billion. That's enormous. In my mind, what that is basically in a sense, a classic old school currency devaluation, and quite a large one. If you massively increase the supply of money, you're devaluing the currency. But people didn't really perceive it as that. And I think economists tend not to look at these kind of things as much as they should, so it wasn't really perceived as that. But when you devalue the currency massively, you create a situation where everything becomes temporarily too cheap because people don't immediately adjust their prices, right? So some prices adjust immediately, you know, like the gold price, like the stock markets. They adjust very, very quickly to this increase in money supply, like almost as the announcement is made. But other things like houses take a long time. And the classic, very slow moving price is wages. You know, you don't say, oh, the government, did you know the government's printed £450 billion? Can I have a pay rise? People don't say that. So what you get is a situation where for a while, wages are just way, way too cheap because all the other prices in the economy have gone up and wages haven't gone up. And I think that really explains very well what we're seeing now, which is simultaneously a very weak economy and a collapse in living standards and a lot of vacancies because people have a lot of money and prices haven't adjusted yet. But prices will adjust and they are in the process of adjusting. And when that happens, you'll probably see that vacancy rate come down. But with regards to unemployment, I think this idea that in a weak economy you have high unemployment, I think it's a little bit anachronistic in the sense that we had a very weak economy in the 10 years after 2008. But for most of that, unemployment was low. And I think if you slash unemployment benefits and support for unemployment people, and you also devastate wages, you put poor people in a situation where they have to find a job. They really have to find a job. And I think in a sense, a high unemployment rate is a degree of, that tells you that the economy is weak, but not so weak that people will die if they don't work. Is that we have people in this country, we have people in this city now that are homeless and working. So can you really afford to be unemployed? I think the amount of poverty we're going to see in this country, unemployment has become a luxury. You know, we don't have a dole that can support a life anymore. You have to find a job. You know, so I think if you create a welfare state which does not make unemployment a situation where you can survive for a prolonged period of time, then no matter how weak your economy is, you will have low unemployment. Because if people are forced to choose between dying and working, they'll find a job.
Yeah. God, it's really bleak, isn't it?
So what needs to happen? What needs to happen? What's the alternative? We need to lift Zoe a little.
Okay, yes. Let's come to hopeful. So listen. First things first, look, I quit £1 million a year job to do this. And I wouldn't have done that if I thought there was absolutely no chance of us changing things. There are signs for optimism. And I think one thing that this has done, this crisis, well, I think it's entrenched an existing belief amongst an increasing majority of ordinary people, especially young ordinary people, that the current economic status quo is completely failing. And I think increasingly that is not a counter-consensus view or even a view which is, you know, held only on the left. I think that is increasingly the norm, especially for young people. People can increasingly see that what is happening now is not working and people want change. People want change and things are going to get worse. They will get worse significantly, especially in the winter when people start needing to heat their homes. But people don't want this. People don't want what's happening. People know it's broken and people want change. So, you know, when you create this kind of economic devastation, you open up this political space for people to come out and defend their interests. And, you know, and that's why I do what I do, which is trying to explain to people what's happening and trying to bring people together to push for a positive alternative. And that is why what I'm really pushing right now is for people to have it explained to them clearly just how much money was given to the rich in the last 2 years. And I think if people knew that, they would say, this is totally unacceptable. We have to change the status quo. If you combine that with a message that the rich don't pay taxes, we have a chancellor who is the 222nd richest person in the country, worth over £700 million, whose father-in-law is one of the richest men in the world, and his response to the crisis was to raise national insurance, which is a tax specifically on working people, which specifically excludes income from wealth such as his income, people would be up in arms. People would be up in arms. But I think it's, unfortunately, the case is not being made in the media. I don't see why anyone is saying anything other than we gave the rich £450 billion. If we got that back, we could increase our support by 5,000%. We desperately need to get that back and they're not paying any taxes. The case has never been clearer. Never in the history of economics has it been more obvious what a society needs to do economically. But unfortunately, the case is not being made. But if we made that case well enough, then people would support us and we can make that change. But it's a case of whether we can make that case compellingly.
You obviously emphasise a lot that, like, wealth tax really important. It seemed to me when the energy crisis, like, really hit, one simple thing that the government could have done is just capped the price rise at 4%. And then that would obviously have created a problem for all of the private energy companies. But then maybe the government could have given them loans to cover the cost that maybe would convert to equity, convert to public ownership at a certain stage with an option to. And so I was just wondering how, whether you agree with that, and also whether you think that you need to combine that redistributive politics that you're talking about with public ownership as well as a kind of part of this strategy.
Yeah, so there's quite a bit of detail that needs to be filled in if you talk about price caps on energy. Because say you bring in a price cap on energy, there's two different ways you can do that, right? You can make that directly government subsidy, where you basically say the government buys it at market from the energy companies and then sells it to the consumer at this price cap level, in which case you're talking about a significant government loss, which, you know, how are you going to fund that? You can fund that through more printing, but that's probably inflationary. If you fund that through taxes on the rich, then I'm super happy. But, you know, are we doing that? Are we talking about, basically, if you do that, if you set the price cap, who are you setting to take the loss? Are you setting the loss to the government, or are you setting the loss to the energy companies? Because if you set the loss to the energy companies, then they will respond by reducing supply, right? And then are you then going to mandate supply? Are you going to say, look, you have to provide this amount at that price? And then the energy companies will take a significant loss. And these are two different propositions, basically.
Yeah, I suppose the way I was thinking about it, you would basically pass the loss to the shareholders of the energy companies. That will create a problem for their share price, obviously. And then that kind of opens up possibilities for changing how those energy companies are run and changing how the energy market works through something like public ownership.
Okay, so in that case, you're talking about basically taking a big chunk of value directly from the energy companies. I mean, it's probably better than the status quo, which is dropping the loss with the consumer. And that falls much, much more heavily on poorer consumers who spend a much higher percentage of their expenditure on energy. My concern is there's a kind of a random arbitrariness about it, in the sense that we exist in a space where in the last 2.5 years, we have given an unbelievably enormous amount of money to rich people in general. Some of them own energy companies and some of them don't. And energy companies have actually underperformed the stock market in the course of the last 2.5 years. And then there's a price rise in energy and we say, okay, we raid the energy companies. And I think the problem with this is, if we use this kind of reactive method where we don't tax the rich broadly, but we tax specific groups of people who happen to be in politically weak positions at a political point in time, it gives the very rich and very powerful a good way of just driving us against each other to tax specific politically unfortunate groups of people whilst the rich in general do well. I think there's a problem with just saying, okay, now food's expensive, so let's tax the owners of the land. Now energy's expensive, let's tax the owners of the energy, whilst at the same time, wealth generally accumulates massively. Do you see what I'm saying? It's important to understand the systemic problem. Because, you know, certain rich people own newspapers, you know what I mean? And if they can drive, you know, it becomes somewhat of a witch hunt. You know, not all rich people own energy companies. And not all people who own energy companies are rich. You know what I mean? I've got a friend who's saving up to buy a house and he's put all of his savings in Shell stock, which I advised against him doing, but he's not a rich guy. And, you know, is this the guy you want to take the loss? You know, I think it's important to understand systemically what's happening and to take the rich people in general in a way that is fair. Because, you know, otherwise, what you will end up with is a situation where rich people gang together to protect their own specific interests and attack one another.
Yeah. I mean, I was interested. I interviewed Martin Lewis, who, you know, nobody would think of as a firebrand, but he was saying that energy costs were essentially a poll tax because as a result of the cap, unless you were really, really, really rich, you know, 10-bedroom house rich, everybody's energy costs had kind of broadly fallen into line. So they were biting a huge amount more out of a poor household's budget than a middle-income household's budget. Is there a danger as well that when progressive policies become quite timid, they often end up being really counterproductive?
I think the problem you have, and I think Martin Lewis's narrative on this has been really interesting, right? Like, he's the big In a sense, Martin Lewis is like the firebrand of individualism. He's like, listen, it doesn't matter if the system is screwing you over, because you can continually change your energy provider and you can change your mortgage provider and you can wheedle your way out and you can protect yourself and your family. And he's recently come out and basically said, I'm sorry, but I'm out of ideas here. There's nothing you can do. It is inevitable that you will fall into poverty. And I think this is what happens when you create a society which really tells individuals, look, don't worry about the system. Focus on you and your family. Meanwhile, the rich are continually becoming richer and richer and richer and taking your assets. Which is, if you take wealth and assets and power away from the masses and towards the rich, it will eventually become impossible for ordinary people to afford a basic quality of life. So I think this sort of semi-road to Damascus theme from Martin Lewis is basically the realization that just taking care of yourself and your family doesn't work. And this is a big thing that I'm talking about on my YouTube lately, which is, look, you know, because, you know, I was a former trader and I made a lot of money, but now I'm trying to get people politically engaged. And a lot of the messages that I get are, look, I'm struggling. What can I do? Or how can I make money trading? Or can you give me tips trading Bitcoin? And the problem is, look, this doesn't work. This doesn't work. If you allow your community and your society to lose their assets, their wealth, their power, then eventually it will become impossible for you as an individual and you as a family to protect yourself. So what I'm trying to tell people is, look, the individually rational thing to do for yourself and your family is to come together with your friends, your community, and push back politically, because this is the only way you're going to win. You're not going to beat the billionaires one-on-one, but you can beat them in the voting booth and politically if you are sensible.
As for the Labour Party, I mean, it has been, I've been very dispirited this week by, you know, what seems to be a growing timidity from Starmer. But, I mean, listening to you, I sort of think that we need to completely rethink what we want from them, because just wishing they were a bit more like they were under Corbyn isn't going to do it either.
Yeah. So at the moment, I don't worry about the Labour Party. The Labour Party takes up like 1% of my brain space. I don't worry about the Labour Party. Before the reshuffle, some sort of senior people used to talk to me in the Labour Party and, you know, about economic policy and about what they need to be doing and about messaging. And we used to talk a bit. Since the reshuffle, nobody senior has spoken to me. And you know what? I don't really care, because I don't see positive change coming from that space at the moment. And listen, don't get me wrong. There'll be people who are in the Labour Party that are fighting to improve that space. 100% keep fighting, keep doing that, because the Labour Party is important. But the way I see it right now is, we need to build a movement which is coming from ordinary people, which is connected to ordinary people. That's what I'm trying to do, and that's what I want to do. Because, like, I've been floating around this space for a while, and what I feel is a disconnection from ordinary people. So look, when I first started, I wrote some articles for Open Democracy, I wrote for The Guardian, and, you know, in my opinion, they were good articles, you know, speaking for myself. And I got a little bit well known in this kind of space of people who read about left-wing economics. But listen, I'm not from that background. People where I'm from don't read those publications. But those are the people who are being affected. And these people, ordinary people, they're dying to have positive change, man. They're seeing really serious bad things happen in their life. And that is why I made the switch away from writing articles towards pushing a YouTube. Because the way I see it, on a YouTube, you can create a space where ordinary people can come in, feel like a guy is speaking to them in their language in a way that they can understand about their problems. And that's where people can get on board, man. And I think that, for me, to be honest, those are the spaces that I'm interested in. Online spaces that are open to ordinary people, because, you know, I exist in this space now, in media, think tanks. And to be honest, in my opinion, in my experience, it's a very left-wing space. And listen, I come at this space with fire, because this affects my family. And this affects all the people I grew up with. And I see what is happening to people. But I see the people in this space, often it's a theoretical debate for them. So for me, I'm trying to create an online space which is based in ordinary people, because it will come with that aggression and that fire and that need for change. So look, I'm open. Listen, if the Labour Party leadership changes or they change their angle, but the way I'm seeing it, I'm going to build up a movement of ordinary people that is going to force the Labour Party to listen, because I don't trust those guys to do it. So I'm going to do it myself.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Well, I'm going to become one of your disciples.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah. Keep pushing. We're trying. We're trying our best to grow it. It is growing. We went through 10,000 subscribers yesterday on the YouTube, and I've got plans to grow more.
Wow, what a conversation. Thank you, Gary.
Yeah, it's been great, Gary.
It's very galvanising, and
that's all right.
But it's not very cheerful.
We should maybe we won't leave it as long to invite you back on the podcast next time.
yeah, no worries. Let me know.
It'll be great to have this conversation again.
That concludes this episode of the Another Europe podcast. We enjoyed making it so much that we decided to put none of it behind a paywall this week. But please help us keep making these pods by joining the Another Europe is Possible campaign. Another Europe is the home of the pro-European left. To make it your home too, go to anothereurope.org/join. Thanks for listening. We'll be back again very soon.